Okay, so I'm going to talk about this way of extending continuous fractions to higher dimensions and then try to apply to a normalization problem. So basically, normalization usually is set up of small divisor problems that appear in dynamical systems. People need to use continuous fractions. And that was restricted to the one-dimensional case. In order to extend to higher dimensional systems, we needed some multidimensional continuous fraction algorithm. And so the first part of the talk will be try to describe a way to do it. And the second part will to apply to one example using normalization in a specific problem. And using this method. Okay, so this first part is in the midst of a joint work with Kostya Karin and Jens Marklov. And well, the basic problem is to find an algorithm, so given some vector in our alpha, in our d minus 1 dimensions, NED. So we want to find a sequence of rational approximations. So rational numbers or vectors, such that they converge to alpha, or you can even add some extra convergence properties to make it more strong. We're going through that later. So another way to see the problem is given a vector omega, which is basically the same alpha as up there, but we add some extra component, and we want to find some sequence of matrices with determinant 1, integer matrices, that expand the direction of omega and contract everything else. So basically having some positive Lyapunov exponent in that direction. Okay, so I start with the kind of original idea by Lagarias from number theory, 94. So the idea comes from him, basically. And what he does is he constructs some lattice, d-dimensional lattice, unimodular lattice, just by considering the d minus 1 so canonical basis and add one extra dimension by this vector. I just put the minus there for some convenience, but it could be alpha 1, so the previous omega we're talking about. So these lattices can be constructed by writing up a basis. I call it here b naught, which the vectors and the columns are the vectors that generate the old basis. This is a matrix with determinant 1. It's in SLDR. Call this G. Of course, the basis defines the lattice up to some change of basis, the vectors, by some matrix in SLDZ gamma. So the lattice, the space of lattices will be the Gaussian space. And kind of just to explain more or less what's going on here, a point in the lattice can be written in this way. You just apply an integer matrix to this basis. So when we want to find good rational approximations to alpha, this is going to correspond to write a point in the lattice in this form. This is a generic point in the lattice, and we want this to be close to zero. The Pn minus Qn alpha wants to. We want this to go to zero, such way that we Pn over Qn is a rational approximation of alpha. Okay, so in a sense, what we are going to look for are the points in the lattice that are very close to the vertical axis of the lattice. So just putting this in a drawing. So this is the lattice Legaris constructed. And so this repeats everywhere. And so the points that are close to this vertical direction are the ones that correspond to good rational approximations. So how are we going to find them? What is the idea to discover which points are these? So the thing is that we're going to deform this lattice, sending everything vertical direction, contracting the vertical direction, expanding all others, in a way that all the points are close to the vertical axis, at some point will be very close to the origin. So those will become shortest vectors in the lattice, and so we proceed some change of basis to get the shortest vectors, and immediately we're getting the rational approximations, the ones we're interested in. Okay, this is the general idea. The point then is to construct. So this deformation we're going to do is by applying to the original basis this matrix ET, which is contract or expanding all the, let's say, the horizontal directions and contracting the vertical directions. Determinant one again. So the new basis of the new lattice will be this one, and then we want to change the basis by some matrix P of T in gamma, so in SLDZ, in a way that we get the shortest vectors, and this way we get the what we want. Okay, just as a reference, Legaris didn't exactly put it the flow like this. He constructed the basis slightly different with some parameter S in here, but it's more or less the same idea. So everything, what we're doing is a one parameter flow on the space of lattices when deforming the original one. We now look at this in a more general situation. So we look at the flow on homogeneous space of lattices. And at this point, I should mention also Margulis and Kleinbock, as people work on this. And, the flow that we're looking at is by starting with some matrix M, and then we do this action by E of T on the left, could be on the right. This flow is actually ergodic and mixing. And now we are more interested in looking at the flow, just restricted to the fundamental domain. So we just define the same way. And where this matrices P of T are the unique, is the unique family, one parameter family, that brings the flow back to the fundamental domain. So every time this flow gets out of the fundamental domain, this matrix T changes to bring it back. Okay. So for intervals of time, we always get a constant P of T, and then it changes some critical times, which correspond to the flow getting out of the fundamental domain. Okay, and these are exactly the matrices that correspond to the multidimensional continuous fraction we're going to use when we start with the initial condition given by this matrix. It's basically the original lattice constructed by the guys. Okay, so we start with this initial condition, look at the flow, and write the PT as that way. And what we're going to find out is this matrix, or these matrices P of T, are going to exponentially expand omega and contract everything else. At the same time, we can construct a new vector omega of t, which is omega in the new after changing basis by these matrices P of t. And then we add some normalizing constant there, lambda t, to just get the new vector omega t as alpha t of, and the last component equal to 1. Okay. Another property that we can easily get from here is that if we start with an orthogonal vector from omega, and then you apply the matrix P of t transpose, in this case, you still get a vector which is orthogonal to omega of t. Okay, these properties, or this way to put things, is what is going to be used in normalization problems related to small devices that I'm going to then to apply later. Okay, so this was the construction. Then you get some results. Well, Legaris got with this method quite a few results. Well, first of all, he finds a unique sequence of these critical times, means the times that you leave the fundamental domain and go back. So this means that P of t is constant in some interval where t is between two times or two critical times there. And then it's different everywhere else. So it means that Pt only changes at these times of this sequence. I'm going to that point later. Just next slide starts with that. Okay, well, the if you write the P of the Tn's in this way, with the Pn's and the Qn's, so the P's are vectors, so in the column, D minus 1 dimensions. So you have convergence, some strong convergence, actually. Then he also says that you can have some subsequence of these Tn's, which give you some, the best simultaneous approximations in the sense of kind of for the Euclidean norm. Kind of what do you expect to see in the Gauss map and the usual continuous fractions where you get the best Diophantine approximations. In particular, for the equals to the dimensions, where you're looking at the case of alpha as an irrational number, this Pn, this subsequence gives you this Pn case over Qn case. And this is actually a subsequence of the normal continuous fractions, or the standard one. Okay, so in a sense, for the two-dimensional case, getting this subsequence, this method gives you an accelerated version of the Gauss map. Okay, well, now to your question. There's no much knowledge about the fundamental domains, and this causes a problem for specific applications we're looking at when we want to characterize the Diophantine vectors in terms of this expansion. The exception is the two-dimensional case where we know what is the fundamental domain. So this is restricted to the model surface, and you look at the geodesic flow there, and you can actually get the Gauss map out of there. Higher dimensions is more tricky, more complicated. We don't know how this fundamental domain works. So for Lagarias, he doesn't need to, but we need when we want to get some estimate for the Diophantine vectors and things like that. Okay, so instead of the fundamental domain, we use zero sets, which are simple connected sets that contain the fundamental domain and is inside copies, the union of several copies, finite number of copies of the fundamental domain. Okay, and this turns out to be sufficient for our purpose. So an example of these legal sets for that we use is given by this Aiwazawa decomposition of these matrices. And so we can decompose these matrices as a product of three matrices. The first one is N, which is an upper triangular matrix with ones on the diagonal. The A is a diagonal matrix with the determinant one also, and all positive entries. And K is a matrix in SOD. Ah, it's here. I put it here. Okay, so we construct the Ziegle sets in this case by putting these conditions on the matrix N A, and Q is N. Okay, so the most relevant thing that we're going to see is the value of this AD there that we are going to be used for the estimates that are next. Okay. Okay, the next step, so for a normalization we basically need two things. Is this hyperbolicity property that these matrices expand the direction by omega and contract everything else, and then the control on the norms of these matrices Pn. They cannot grow too fast for specific vectors like Diophantines, otherwise the normalization diverges and so on. So these are the two main things that we're looking at. So for the estimate on these norms, we start by looking at this function delta. And this function delta basically gives us the size of the shortest vector in the lattice. So it's a function on the homogeneous space, and you compute the smallest vector there. Okay, so we can actually for matrices inside the Ziegle set, not just the fundamental domain, because we couldn't do it for the fundamental domain. So we use this case. We can estimate this function, so the size of the shortest vector, by the thing that I just said before. So it's the last component of the matrix, the diagonal matrix on the Aiwazawa decomposition. Okay, and this allows us to start computing estimates for the norms of the matrices. So the same matrix, the norm of this matrix is then bounded by some constant over the size of the shortest vector, the inverse again. And then if we look at the flow, which is on the fundamental domain, but we know that the fundamental domain is inside the Ziegle set, so we can write the same kind of estimate. So for the flow, the inverse is estimated by the size of the shortest vector of already deformed lattice. This is what is written here. And we get the same for MT. For P of T, the norm of P of T, you also get this. The exponential part here comes because P of T is the product of the MT times the E of minus T and so on. So the inverse and the P of T are bounded in this way. Okay. So for a specific case of the Diophantine vectors that give you initial condition for this flow, we have other types of some lower bounds of this function delta of t. So for some Diophantine numbers or vectors, the size of the shortest vector cannot go to zero very fast. Okay, so Diophantine vector, I write this a vector on the set of BC of beta. Beta is the exponent on this definition, general definition. So if we do the union of all sets of all Diophantine vectors, you get a full measure. Actually, you don't need to do that much, but we are treating all the Diophantines, no respect to specific beta, in the same way. So this is a full measure set. If we consider only the case of beta equals to zero, which you get just a zero measure set. Okay. This case beta equals to zero is the case of constant type vectors, and this is can be seen on our flow because the flow is actually bounded if omega is on that set. Okay. Well, let me remind you that this flow is ergodic, so you can have a bounded thing unless you had a zero measure set of things. Okay, now we tried to, this is due to Dani, we tried to kind of get the same result of a bound for the size of where the m of t, the flow is, for the Diophantine numbers. And so we managed to see that if we have a Diophantine vector, then the size of the shortest vector at any point t is bounded from below by this expression. So beta is the Diophantine exponent, d is the dimension. So the vectors cannot go to zero very fast. Okay, this already gives us, because of what I said before, estimates for the norms of the matrices. I just wanted to do a remark here, is that the implication on the other direction can be done for the case of two dimensions, so the classical case. For the higher dimensional case, it's probably not true. And there's a fundamental reason behind this, is the thing is that in two dimensions, the fundamental domain only has one way to go to infinity, to diverge. So it's only one cusp. This means that if one vector of the base is going to zero, the shortest vector is going to zero, is the only option, because the other one has to grow very fast. Just to remind you that the determinant of this determinant is one of the these lattices, so it's unimodular lattice. In the case of more dimensions, you can have actually two vectors going to zero, and the third one, for instance, three dimensions, go very large. So this means that the fundamental domain might have, well, has more cusps. So what does this mean? It means that if we don't, we might have a non-Diophantine number or a vector, a Liouville vector that has this kind of, or satisfies this kind of bound, lower bound. Because it's going through one cusp, comes back, goes to another cusp, comes back, and this will not happen in two-dimensional case. So we cannot prove equivalence in here. So in some respect, this is a disadvantage of this method, in a way that in continuous fractions, if you get a continuous fraction, you look. If I give you the a sequence of matrices with some growth on their norms, I immediately can say which type of vector is Diophantine or not. In this case, it's not true. So this limitation, for some way, in a way, to normalization, that if we want to find some optimal results for normalization, this will be a limitation for higher dimensions. Okay. Okay, so I said what to think that we were interested in the continued fraction. One was this estimate on the norms, the control on the growth of the norms of the matrices. The other one is the upper probability. Well, for the Offenstein case, it's not difficult then to use the estimates we got to prove that if we're getting a vector orthogonal to omega, the Offenstein, then these matrices, or the transpose of these matrices, actually shrinks that direction in this way. So we might have to wait, because of this constant, we might have to wait t to get some time sufficiently bigger, you get contraction. Okay. We for purpose of the normalization, we are actually interested in what we call the transfer matrices, which is kind of discretizing this flow of PT. And so we just get any sequence Tn. The only requirement is that you have a change of P. So I just recall the P is constant in some interval and then changes whenever you have to go back to the fundamental domain. So we can construct like this transfer matrices. So we get all the same properties from the original ones for the Tn's. So we get here hyperbolicity. Now the theta here is just to simplify notation. The delta Tn is the difference between the times of the sequences Tn, and we have bounds for the matrix Tn for inverse. Now we are going to choose this sequence Tn, which we call stopping times, or whatever you want to call. We're going to choose it in a way that we have hyperbolicity here, so this goes to zero. So in a way, you have to see that the spaces between the Tn's have to grow more than this, for depending on the type of the Offenstein you're considering. Okay, and the same for the norms. So we get at this point some kind of freedom in the choice, and well, this is just what I said. So you choose these stopping times so that you have hyperbolic matrices at each step. So for each transfer matrix, and not just for the old PT, the old flow. And this is what you need to do normalization, so iterations of the normalization operator that we're going to construct based on this. Okay. So this is the idea. Now let's, for a multi-continuous fraction, now let's apply to a problem by using normalization. And the problem I've picked here is a problem of reducibility of skew flows. And this is a joint work with Hans Koch. So I hope I don't say anything wrong. Okay, so the setup is the following. We consider a Lissow group of all these matrices, n by n, complex or real. And we take Lie algebra of that Lie subgroup. We pick a vector, omega, which can be written as alpha 1, as we were looking before. We pick a function, a smooth function. It's going to be a smooth function on the torus with values on the Lie algebra. And we can see the vector fields on the manifold, which is TD cross this Lie group. The vector fields are going to have this form. So on the basis, on the torus, you just have a constant vector given by omega. So the base component, the toroidal component, is just a linear toroidal flow. And then on the fiber, you get on G, you get this differential equation. So a linear system. So this can be seen as a linear differential equation with time-depending coefficients. Now the time dependence will depend on the type of omega, if it's rational dependent or is a rational vector, gives you to different types of behavior. So the flow that this vector field generates is what we call the linear skew flow. The base is just the linear toroidal flow, and on the fiber there's some solution for this. Well, if D is 1, so D is the dimension of the basis, or if you have a rational dependent vector, this is a flow case theory, so it means so standard EDOs, so it's periodic dependent coefficients, and the flow is reducible in this sense that we can have some coordinate transformation that transforms our original flow with time dependent coefficients into a constant. Coefficients are all constant in this linear part. Okay, so another way to see this is by looking directly to the vector field. So the vector field is reducible if we can find a coordinate transformation of this type. So it's the identity on the base and a linear transformation on the fiber that brings the original vector field to a constant on the fiber, constant matrix there. Okay. So, as I said, the periodic results are known. Then the next thing to do was the quasi-periodic results. This is already an old problem, more than 20 years. So, if to solve it, we started with KM methods, and I think it was Dinneburg and Sinai the first people to approach the problem in the context of one-dimensional Schrödinger equation. Moser and Porschel again, and then Eliasson kind of made more general results. So reducibility in some specific conditions. And then for compact Lie groups, Raphael Krikorian also did lots of results. I mentioned here that dimension here is any. Then, using normalization methods, just for two dimensions, basically because of the continued fraction that is needed to be used. So, it started for the compact Lie group case of SU2, Wischlich and Krikorian later improved Wischlich's results. And quite recently, for the non-compact case of SL2R, Arthur Avila and Rafael Krikorian also solved the problem. Okay, using normalization now for higher dimensions, this is what I'm going to talk now, a few minutes. And this was for any subgroup of these cases. And then what's lacked after this is do some kind of global thing for the higher dimensional case. Okay, just present you the main result that we can get in higher dimensional case using normalization. Well, this is already seen. So this is the type of vectors we are interested in. The Diophantine vectors, the same thing that I just showed before. Well, these things are defined on the torus. You do Fourier expansion of the functions. In particular, I put this E of F for the constant mode, constant Fourier mode. I minus E is just the non-constant mode. This is just abbreviation for what is written here. So the theorem then says that for the Diophantine vectors, if you have sufficiently smooth maps, it means that this gamma is bigger than this. The expression only depends on dimension and the type of the Diophantine. Then we can find a manifold called M. So this is a Rocker result, so it's inside some ball around the origin of the smooth maps or gamma smooth maps, such that, well, this manifold is a graph. Just kind of make a schematic drawing of this manifold, a graph of an analytic map, and with the property that if F is on this manifold, then the vector field is reducible to the zero vector field. Well, you lose a bit of smoothness on the reducibility, so this means that the reducible map is slightly less smooth than the original map. Okay, so we did this for vector fields close to the zero one, or to functions f close to zero. We don't need to put zero there. We want to make something close to another function g, which, to close to a constant a instead of zero. We can still do kind of as a corollary of the previous theorem through a few comments. Well, now we have to add some extra Diophantine conditions. It's no longer just to the omega, but to the omega and to this other constant a, where so we want this to be closer to this thing. So we starting by the case where g is actually a, and a written on this form, where the kappa is a vector in Rd, and the j i's are matrices that that are make this map 2π periodic and linear independent commuting in the Lie algebra. We are basically interested, well, we can see this is a generalization of the case that is more obvious when you look at SL2R, where you have this kind of matrices that make rotations on the plane, and the kappa is simply the rotation number. Okay, well, in this case, it's when g is equal to a, it's pretty obvious that the flow then is conjugated to a flow which is a vector no longer on just the TD, on the torus, but we extend the torus for more L components, because here gives you a rotation, so we add everything that's going around or gyrating, we add everything into the torus. So we extend the base of the flow and put the zero there. So, and then we go back to the previous case where we are looking at vector fields close to zero. Okay, now we want to look at something close to A. So we do the same kind of interpretation. We look at the circle motion on the matrices and add this to the torus on the base, so we get a new system. So we are doing, what we're doing is treating all frequencies, the internal, which is the rotation number on the matrices, and the external, which is the omega on the base. And this reduction can be done easily by some kind of transformation of this type. So this big theta gives you something like this. The vector, the function, then will become this thing, and this will now be near zero. Okay, so this immediately, using the previous theorem, which I'm going to just give a hint on the idea of the proof, which uses renormalization. So, just following the previous slide, the corollary is that if you have now omega and kappa as Diophantine, and G is in a copy of the manifold M given by the transformation, then it's reducible. I have to mention here that, for instance, for the case that Eliasson worked, it's slightly better than this, because Eliasson only requires omega to be Diophantine, and then puts a condition on kappa to be Diophantine with respect to omega, and it's kind of more general than this case. Anyhow, this has advantage that we can do everything in a unified way. Okay. Okay, restricting to the case of SL to R, in this case we can define the rotation number, and it's actually the case that Eliasson treated. The corollary before was more general, so another difference between those results. Anyway, we can define the rotation number easily. It's just the way the matrices are rotating. And then we just write the theorem quite close to the other theorem, using these ideas of extending the basin, etc. Okay, I'm not. I think I'm going running out of time. Just the last slide. Oh, still. Okay, so let me just go through this theorem, just not to be completely empty. So the result here that we have is that again, if you have some sufficiently good smoothness there, you pick a matrix on SL to R, which is a traceless matrix, 2 by 2. The eigenvalues imaginary. And then this condition that you have a Diophantine condition on the eigenvalue, exactly the omega and the eigenvalue. Then again, you have some ball of smooth maps where you can find a map there on that ball and a unique parameter such that the rotation number of G plus lambda A is the K, which is the rotation number of the matrix A. And this new function or vector field is reducible. Okay, so the point here is, first of all, is to change a linear change to make A on this form. Well, this is basic stuff because you have imaginary eigenvalues. And then use that big theta argument or coordinate transformation to reduce to the problem of the theorem one, so the close to zero problem. And then you look at this new map, adding the parameter, and this intersects the manifold at one point, and because of that has rotation number zero. Okay. All right, so this was using the what I call here the theorem one, and okay, so just the idea of the proof, which uses renormalization, and we did the multi-dimensional continuous fractions. So the point here is common to many normalization applications. You construct a normalization operator by making several transformations or coordinate transformations. First one, called here T, is the torus rescaling, so are the matrices that we get from the multidimensional continuous fraction, and we apply on the base. And the rescaling also comes from there. Another thing that we need to use is the Faber uniformization, which is a close to the identity transformation. This is basically to reduce infinite dimensions to a family of d dimensions, or d family, d dimensional family, which is the usual picture of normalization. That is, we are reducing everything to this universal family, which corresponds to the unstable direction of a normalization fixed point. Our case is not a very difficult fixed point to find, is zero. The stable manifold is actually the manifold M, where everything is reducible to zero, and the fixed point is hyperbolic, and this mainly comes from the fact that the continuous fractions are hyperbolic matrices. Well, what you said, and this finishes well. So that's what I just said. Okay, that's all I wanted to say.